Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as we bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you're a regular listener, thank you for joining us once again. Now, if this is your first time, please make yourself at home as we bring you Answers for the Family. And each week, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and skilled authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, while my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, takes time away from the show, we're bringing in some wonderful guest hosts who, like Matt, are making a positive difference in the lives of others. Now, my guest host today is Gabriella Von Rey. For those of you that didn't hear our show a few weeks ago, she was our guest and our topic was kindness. So Gabriella, who was adopted from a Pakistani orphanage at the age of 3 by a Dutch family, she was raised in Holland and she learned about bullies and racism the hard way. But she refused to remain a victim. Instead, she used understanding and empathy to defeat fear and mistrust. Now she is seen on national TV and speaks at school assemblies and major corporations across the United States, spreading her messages, which are, let's pick up our standards, let's pick up our values. And her slogan is, we as a society have dropped the ball of human kindness. Will you help me pick it up? Gabriella, I'm so happy you could join us for today's topic, Teaching with Tenderness, a lesson plan for bringing higher awareness to education.
I am so excited to hear Dr. Becky Thomas interview about teaching with tenderness. I am totally psyched about that today.
Well, I am glad to hear you and to share with our guest a little bit about our guest. Dr. Becky Thompson is a scholar. She's a human rights and anti-racism activist. She's also a cross-cultural trainer, a writer, a poet, and a senior-level yoga teacher. So Becky has lectured on race, gender, and class issues around the world. She has served as a human rights advocate on the front lines of the refugee crisis in Greece, where she has assisted people seeking asylum, documented human rights violations, and taught writing workshops for refugees. Becky has contributed thought leadership, scholarships, and consultation to various interest groups organizational transformation, yoga principles, trauma healing, and survivors on the yoga mat, stories from those healing from trauma, and Zero is the Hole I Fall Into at Night. Becky's writing and activism has been recognized with honors from the Rockefeller Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Association for University Women, and the Ford Foundation, to name just a few. Becky, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's a pleasure to get to hear about Gabriella Von Rey as well. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, you're very welcome, and I was so glad to be able to have her join us when we were looking at the topic, having just had her on the show. I thought, what a perfect one to have her come in and join us. So I'm just happy to have both of you here.
So we can have a conversation among us.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Hey, Becky, my first question to you is, you teach sociology, you are a poet, you teach yoga, and you have written multiple books. And you most recently spent time observing refugee crisis off the shores of Greece. Please tell us a little bit more about yourself and how all of these tie together.
Well, I'm always looking for how the connections occur. And increasingly, I'm understanding that there is a higher presence that guides me. in my life, and I'm not talking about this from a religious perspective, but more as if there is a force that I've been able to tap into that I was most aware of when I was standing on the shore waiting for rafts to come from Turkey that included families from Syria and Pakistan and Iraq and Iran and Palestine, and walking with them up the mountain pass, the families, and through the island of Lesbos, through the first months of the crisis and then coming back several times since, it's as if some kind of courage that they have came inside of my body. Just walking with them and experiencing their dignity helped me to feel stronger in my back body, in my own spine. So I think that part of what connects the work that I do is being able to tap into what the Desmond Tutu refers to as Ubuntu, which means born to belonging. And the moments when I feel that most intensely, that we are born to belong to each other, is when I'm best able to understand how to connect the poetry with the yoga, with being a mother, with being a teacher.
Wow. I love what you said, especially the belonging part. Would you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I have talked about that on different stages, because I feel that when adults or children don't belong, that's when we get into trouble, basically. So I'm really interested. What is the belonging, and how does it work in what you're doing?
Well, when I think about a little bit about your own story that Alan has shared with us, I think immediately about the Pakistani young people that I worked with in Greece, because many Pakistani families that knew that their young sons were in danger put all the resources together that they had in order to send, in some ways, the best and the brightest across those many countries to try to escape military and escape violence. And those young people that were referred to as, quote, unaccompanied minors were away from their families in terms of the physical body, but they had their families with them because their families gave them their blessings. And I watched how they created family among each other over the months, how they hung together and held on to each other when they were alone and waiting in limbo. You know, there's 62,000 people that are still currently in Greece in limbo, and many of them are young Pakistani men who are part of families that are holding on to them, at least in spirit, in hopes that they find their way to a country or a space that will welcome them.
You know, Becky, to maybe help for everybody, can you connect the dots a little bit? So explain to us how an American yoga teacher ends up on the shores of Greece helping these people.
Well, like I was saying about that guiding presence, I was quite surprised myself. I was actually in Lesbos, Greece, on sabbatical, having finished a new poetry project. And I was there to work with an elder yogini, Angela Farmer, on her memoir, because there are several memoirs in the world by elder yogis who are men, we don't have any stories by elder yoginis. And Angela is the most revered female yogi in the world, is going to be turning 80 years old this summer. So I went with her to try to be a shepherd or a midwife and sit with her as she was writing her memoir. And the day that I got there, a group of Syrian university students, who I didn't even know were university students from Syria, came walking toward me as I was walking toward the hot springs. And they looked like they could have just walked right out of NYU, you know, or out of UCLA, but they were wet. And I stopped, and they shook my hands, and they were very warm, and then said they had just landed from the rafts, and the raft had capsized, and they had had to keep their bodies totally quiet. so that they wouldn't all go down. And they motioned. They actually drew lines in their bodies of how quiet their alignment had to be in order to be able to make it to the shore. And I was just stunned. How could this be happening? And it turns out that was the very, very beginning of what became hundreds and then thousands of people coming, whole families coming on rafts from Turkey through Turkey from Syria and Pakistan and Palestine and Iraq and Iran. So I became a first responder in that I just stood there and waited, because the smugglers would put 40 or 50 people in a raft that was made for about 8 and then hand the little engine over to somebody on the raft who most likely had never ever used an engine before, and then pointed them. And the currents in the Aegean Sea makes the undertow look ridiculous, because it's all undertow. So people would lose their way. They wouldn't even know how to. And a lot of times it was, you know, at dusk and at dawn. So I would stand on the shore and wave my arms like in a sun salutation back and forth and back and forth, until someone on the raft saw me, and they would wave their arms back and forth and back and forth. And we often did that for like 30 or 40 minutes until they came to the shore. So I was really using yoga right there standing on the shore to try to help pull people in. And, you know, the families were pulling, taking their grandparents with them and pulling the wheelchairs on inner tubes behind the raft. These are upper middle class, multilingual, multi-ethnic families who are risking their lives to save their lives. So I got to Greece on sabbatical, and I was forever changed, and have subsequently gone back 6 times, and tremendously moved by people's courage and integrity.
Well, first, bless you for that. I mean, that's phenomenal. As most people know, that is a very volatile subject here in the United States, the refugee crisis issue. If you had a magic wand and you could make some decisions in that area, what would you see that could be done to help resolve some of these problems?
Well, I'd first work on this whole idea of what refugee crisis means, because that word conjures up so many images that are not accurate. I started to understand that what I was witnessing was the biggest multiracial, multiethnic, intergenerational peace march in modern history. Because the people that are coming across on the rafts are the peacemakers. They're the humanitarians. They're the community workers. They're the people who are running from the violence and want a way to be able to raise their families. So I first say, what will it take for us in the United States to understand that to welcome in a Syrian or Afghan or Pakistani or Palestinian family is to welcome in the peacemakers, welcome in the community workers? And then I think, because I was walking with them day after day, and to realize they spoke many more languages than I do and have tremendous skills, that it's like thinking about how our world will be enriched by the possibility of sharing rather than constraining and constricting. I think about what we're dealing with now in this country is this pulling in and pulling in and pulling in and away from our own spirits and the spirits of other people in the world. And that's damaging to all of us. We know that when you constrict your heart, eventually your heart can't beat in the same kind of way. So I would say, if I had a magic wand, I would say, let's be sure that our hearts are as big as they can be, and our dream is to be able to stand by other people with big hearts.
Hey, Becky, I like your magic wand, and I wish it would work everywhere, worldwide. But just to concentrate on the U.S. for a second, you can imagine myself as a foreigner, I get often told to go home. So how could we teach, how would you teach that these people come in peace? Because I go out there every day doing that part exactly, that the foreigners that we see, we get a bad rap, and we actually come with skills and not totally uneducated, like most of us think that we are.
You know, you raise a crucial question about danger and fear. Mm-hmm. And this country was built on fear. Mm-hmm. when you start a country based on genocide of Native people and slavery, you create a society based on fear, because the oppressors, because of colonial settlers, know what we have done. And I speak about this as a white person, you know, from a Mormon family where my great-great-grandfather had 9 wives, and each of those wives were, quote, given a tract of land, this Native land. Right? So I walk around unconsciously or consciously in fear of what my ancestors and I have done and am complicit in. So first step for me is to work on that fear of my own being haunted by my own ghosts. That's the work of anti-racism, is for white people to understand that we need to come clean about what we have done as a culture. And then there's another step in that, is to recognize that we project that fear onto other people. So the whole notion of the myth of the black rapist was really about the way that white men were legally allowed to rape black women, systematically. The rape of black women by white men was projected onto black people. It's the same thing around the notion of the stranger as the danger. You know, we raise our children to think, don't reach out to strangers, when actually almost all the violence done to children is done within their own homes.
Absolutely.
So we're looking in completely in the wrong place for where the damage is done. And I think going back to, this is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right? That's what Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela taught us, is we have to be truthful about the underpinnings of U.S. society built on slavery and genocide. Come clean about that.
I know.
And make reparations, to the point then when this whole notion about what's a foreigner, you know, birds know much better than we do. They know much better because they don't recognize national borders. National borders are made up.
Of course they're made up. I totally agree with everything you said. I'm actually getting very excited about this conversation. I talk about fear always. If we live with fear, we cannot live with love, kindness, and empathy in our heart. It's just impossible. But there's also this, and I want to kind of see it from both angles. There's also, for the colored man, the feel that the white man, like you say, I hate saying that word, but the Caucasian seems to have it all, and the grass does look greener sometimes on the other side. And so I believe too that we need to educate, but by educating, coming clean is a super notion, and I would love to discuss with you how we could do that. But I also wanted to bring up something, just because it happened yesterday and I happened to see it. I tuned in, like millions of other people, to the Golden Globes, because I knew that Oprah was receiving an award, the Cecil Hill Award, and she is the first black American woman to receive that award. So I thought that was quite special to tune in for that. And I just, when you were talking, I had this, you know, it was just kind of bubbling up from inside of me to say, time's up, because that's what they said yesterday. See, so when I hear your voice, I think it's time for us to create a movement where we not only speak about oppressed women, but that we talk about every single oppressed human being, because it's about our humanity that's going on, right? And I think if I hear you correctly, that is what you experienced over there in Greece, right? The humanity, because it's very different to see on a TV news station than when you see it there, right? The differences were amazing for you. And that opened your eyes and gave you the awakening to do something terrific, which we want to hear more about.
You know, I also got to see the Oprah Winfrey's speech last night when she did say time's up. And part of what I noticed was everyone was on their feet.
Yes.
And everybody was clapping. And people had goosebumps. That, I think, is a fabulous example of tenderness. Tenderness had entered the room when she spoke, right? Because there were these moments, there was a moment that where people were willing to hold in their minds more complexity and paradox and community than they ever thought was possible. She was giving us a fleeting, illuminating reminder that we all belong to each other, right? And then a tenderness that I'm talking about isn't just like touchy-feely. It's about creating structural changes so that everybody is treated from a place of dignity. And some of what makes Oprah Winfrey's work so powerful and generative is her willing to talk from her own lived experience.
Yeah,
she's one of the first people who spoke so eloquently about being a child who had been traumatized herself. And that, I think, is what gives her the gravitas. It gives her the weight now to be able to speak from that subject position. And I commend her. I also say that as I'm actually talking to you from the International Film Festival in Palm Springs, where in the last several days I've gotten to see the new documentary about Sammy Davis Jr. and also the documentary on Wilma Mankiller, who was the first woman Cherokee, the leader of the Cherokee Nation, and also Rumble, which is about how American music has been built on Native beat and the Native drumming and Native sound. And also we got to see Post. And all of these movies have tenderness built into them, these moments when people are willing to take risks and get outside of their comfort zones to create safety and communication that we haven't known before, right? And that risk-taking, I think, is essential for us now because we are in dire times. There's no other way to understand it. And I certainly see hashtag MeToo as part of this forward-thinking, life-saving agenda that I want to celebrate.
Absolutely.
You know, Becky, you mentioned the word tenderness often, and it was one of the things actually Gabrielle and I were talking about is there's so many words out there. There is kindness. There's empathy. Why did you choose tenderness as sort of the base for your work now?
There is a quote by Alice Walker that meant a lot to me when I was early on in the process of writing the book. And she says, if I can just share it with you, a writer's heart, a poet's heart, an artist's heart, a musician's heart is always breaking. It's through that broken window that we see the world, more mysterious, beloved, and precious for the sparkling and jagged edges of the smaller enclosures we have escaped. So for me, what she's talking about is that tenderness that comes from having a broken heart. The tenderness is wisdom. It's willingness to continue to be our vulnerable selves rather than to shut ourselves down. A willingness to regroup and to try again and to take risks beyond our own subject positions, you know.
But often when we are tender and vulnerable, it's when our audience is the most captivated and recipient, meaning really willing to open up back to the person that's speaking. But doing it takes a lot of courage. To be tender takes a lot of courage.
If I'm honest, I spend my life, I don't think I have enough skin to live in the world the way I see the world being. I walk around absorbing a tremendous amount of the anger and the hurt, and that's the reason why I need to have a spiritual practice in my everyday life to keep reminding myself to look to the long, you know, the Native words is about looking seven generations ahead. And there's something about returning to the yoga mat and returning to meditation, returning to free writing, returning to closing circles and talking circles, creating rituals of inclusion that are multiracial and intergenerational. There's something so generative about that that reminds me that it's possible to live with a broken heart and to find other people who also have that experience, that vulnerability. So I wouldn't say it's easy for me to live with this broken heart, but I've been learning to not be ashamed of it.
We are talking with Dr. Becky Thompson, and the subject is the subject of one of her books, Teaching with Tenderness. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. And when we come back, Becky, I'd like to talk a little bit about your book being rooted in your personal life, and if you could share with us a little bit about why you felt this was important. So for everybody out there, please stay with us. Do something tender while we take a break. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. I am here with my guest co-host, Gabriella Von Rey, and we are talking with Dr. Becky Thompson. And when we went to break, we asked that her book, Teaching with Tenderness, seems to be rooted in your personal life. So again, Becky, if you could share with us why you felt this was important.
Some of what motivated me to write the book was my students, and how inspiring it's been to work with students. I've taught at Wesleyan University and at Bowdoin College and at Duke University and the University of Colorado, and also my work at a feminist Buddhist retreat center in northern Thailand and in China, and now teaching poetry in Greece. And there, it's been inspiring to learn from the students and the risks that they're willing to take. But I also think the book came out of my experience when I was a graduate student. I was taking a birth and death course that was offered by my mentor, Maury Stein, and he was teaching, I was actually a teaching assistant, he was teaching about the Holocaust and about nuclear war and about inhumane birthing practices and the attempted genocide of Native people. And this was a profound class. It had 300 students, and I was very overwhelmed. I used to sneak into the bathroom during the break and cry my eyes out and then come back and pretend that I hadn't been crying. And that, I think, was the first part of my saying, what would it need to take for us as teachers to create an environment where if students need to cry, they can cry? What would it take so that we recognize tears as a gift from the gods, you know, rather than something we're supposed to hide away from? The question I'm asking in the book in part is, what happens when teachers carry our minds to one place, to work, to our desks, and our bodies to another, to the gym or outside, or our spirits to another, to a synagogue or a temple or the couch, and our healing to another place, maybe to a psychiatrist or to the mountains? I think the students experience these splits when we're in five different directions. And my question is, what does it take to create a classroom where we can bring our minds and our bodies and our spirits in, so we can bring our emotions in? You know, there's this notion that somehow if you're learning calligraphy or you're learning about the genocide in Rwanda or you're learning about molecular biology, you're somehow not supposed to have the same emotional reaction. But as someone who teaches about many social injustices, I know we need to make space in the classroom for students to be able to have their whole bodies there, to have a range of experiences, because if they can bring in the crying, they can also bring the joy in. It makes space then for a higher way of being and learning with each other.
But that's the hard part, I think, for teachers, because they go from one subject into another. And crying in the classroom, like you said, I think it's seen by many students, and I would even say the teacher, as weakness, the emotions that come yes. with it, correct?
Yes, yes. But if you think about, yes, that's it. And I still get backlash because I try to create a space where people don't have to cordon off their emotions. I still get, hesitation and skepticism. But teaching with tenderness was my coming out of the closet. So my saying, I'm not going to hide that my 25 plus years of teaching has been based on trying to invite the body into the classroom. And also learn how to recognize when people have left their body. You know, there's whole categories of people who have had to leave their bodies because it's not safe to live there. Mm-hmm. At some point, I started to run around and say, you know, to the plumber, are you in your body or, like, are you out of your body? And to dancers, you know, and to cashiers, I was running around asking everyone because I started to realize that when we're not fully in our bodies, we're not even present for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to be present for new information, for understanding the depth of sociology or the depth of philosophy or poetry when we're not even present for ourselves. So I guess I'm still someone who would say when a student cries, we know that they've already made it through the hard stuff. Right? Just by getting to cry, it's like you know you're on a healing path. And we think about how many people have been punished for having real emotion from when we're very, very young, and how that pattern is something that's really blocking us from our full humanity.
You're talking to one of those children.
So yes.
My head is bopping here, Dr. Becky. I was wondering how you could explain to the listeners about the healing within the classroom.
Well, I work with many vets. I work with many students who are overwhelmed by the amount of work that they're needing to do. They're coming in so fearful about not being able to get good jobs or debt after they finish college. I work with a lot of activists, I work with many people from the LGBT community. So part of my work is to help people who are slated to not see each other to be able to start to do that. Right, that there's a possibility of recognizing the classroom as a sacred space, and that if we can create multiracial communication spaces that recognize people's lived experience in the classroom, we have a better chance of creating that in other contexts as well. So I see the classroom as a potential space for liberation. And just like the family can be a space for liberation. But a lot of students who come to the classroom carry a lot of baggage of where they were really beaten up emotionally or intellectually in classes before. You know, where they were told that they were not smart, or they were told that they were not enough. So I try to start from a place of empowerment. Right? There's this beautiful quote by Rumi when he's talking about, if you're in one place and I'm in another, let's try to find a space that is not a right or wrong. It's a field. And he says, and I'll meet you there in that field. That's a beautiful notion, a space beyond right or wrong, a field where we can meet each other. So this place of neither right or wrong opens up a way where there's not so much judgment. When we come as, you know, any other bozo on the bus, willing to take risks and to try to know each other. And, I mean, that raises for me questions about that you're asking me that I would love to ask you. You know, how have you found tenderness in your life?
Well, for me...
Where is tenderness for you?
for me, the word that I use, it's very much like your word tenderness, but I call it might. Mm. In my childhood, I had to dig deep to find my might and to stay true to Gabriella, even though everyone wanted to change my name. People didn't want to accept my skin color. We're talking 1966 in Europe. Adoption was unheard of. So might is one of the ways that I explain where the inner strength comes from, where that guts come from that you were talking about that the refugees have. When you have nothing to lose, the guts kind of comes. And there's my own quote that I use is when your pain becomes your greatest strength, which in turn makes you your cause's best ally. And so you take that pain, you work through it, through crying, through throwing a book around the table, through spending 90% of my time in the hallways at school because I got kicked out for every emotion I ever showed. And and I stayed true to that. And I think that if we teach how to over... my biggest learning skill or learning curve was to find out somewhere between 3.5 and 4 that they were scared of me as I was apprehensive of them, and I couldn't understand that the bully was actually scared of me because I thought they looked very powerful. And so how can a class of 30 children gang up on one and actually be afraid? And when I found that out, that gave me that extra might that I needed to go forward and to say I am who I am. And they told me I didn't belong, and I told them that that was true in some way.
I wish we were face to face because I'm beaming at you. So I'm needing to translate that beaming into the tone of my voice. And part of why I'm beaming at you is because I have two adopted children of color, one of whom is of Trinidadian descent and is 29 now and just brought the most gorgeous granddaughter into my life. And the other is a Native American and African American woman who's now 31, who came and asked me to be her mother when she was 22. And so I will be on the front lines of Black Lives Matter. As long as there is a Black Lives Matter movement to ensure their safety in the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Now, Becky, now you just spoke a little bit about this sort of the people going around with a separation of their mind and their body. And I know that in your book, you talk about the body ransoming or pushing students too hard and migraines that led to develop a more body-centered approach to teaching. And you know, one that kept the intellect in the room while teaching through the body. Can you share a little bit about how this works?
Well, I have to say that I haven't exactly gotten rid of the migraines. They were my clue that I was teaching to the test and asking an intense amount of work at the expense of breath and slow learning. But I also have come to understand the migraines are a sign that we are very much out of sync in this culture. And when a migraine is coming on, I need to look around and say, how am I part of that imbalance? In which ways do I need to get back into my back body and take a breath and slow down? And one of the ways I see that happening in the classroom that need to slow down is I was teaching at Duke University many years ago now, and I was teaching a birth and death course. And, of course, I raised about 9/11 because that was, for many of the young people, like one of the most, present examples of having lived through a death-dealing destruction. And I asked them, where were they on the day that of the 9/11 attacks? And to a person, they said that the teachers just went on with classes as if it hadn't happened. they went through their days as if it wasn't even occurring. So that taught me about our need as teachers to be willing to regroup when emergency happens, to slow down the pace. Even if I have an agenda about what I think I want to get across in that day in terms of a lecture, I need to stop for a bit and give their, make there be space for people to talk about what it means. And what I'm witnessing now is students who are either consciously or unconsciously very afraid of a school shooting. That they are actually walking around in their dorms and in their schools and on the streets afraid that at any time they're going to get attacked. And I think we need to really take that seriously, that fear that they're walking around with, and name it. You know, that it's not just historical memory. It's like, it's a real possibility. And I end up finding myself apologizing to young people for the world that we've handed to them, and that I want to be an ally in whatever ways I can be to make it a safe space again.
Absolutely. I when you were talking about the body ransoming and the out-of-body experience, a question, it's kind of a question and a statement at the same time, Dr. Becky. It's, you know, I feel, and obviously I'm talking about my own experience, that an outer body has two parts. One is part of pain, and so you use it as a self-protection. And I was wondering what you thought about that. And the second part of it is we really do tune out nonstop. Whether we stand in a line at Starbucks, whether we tune out because our mothers have a nagging voice, we tune out continuously, right? So there's two sides of the, if you want to call it, body ransoming. Sorry, I'm not used to that word. So I would like you to look at those two angles. What do you think? How do you connect these students to tell them to be aware, but also the understanding that it is a protection for them to not be in their bodies?
One of the books that are, one of my earlier books is called A Hunger So Wide and So Deep. And it's a multiracial study of eating problems among African-American and Latina and white women. And part of what I learned from doing the life history interviews with women who were in the process of recovering from eating problems, which I think also speaks to other addictions, is that we turn to food or we turn to alcohol, we turn to drugs first as a way to numb ourselves because there are things going on around us that we cannot understand or handle. The addiction starts from a place of survival. It starts from a place of affection for yourself, and then it backfires, right? So for me, some of the healing begins with recognizing that the first inclination is a good one. You know, the first inclination to numb out comes from something outside of us that's saying, hey, you really got to numb out. And there's a reason why children tune in and are not able to focus. You know, there's a reason why there's so much, there's epidemic of addictions. It comes from social conditions that are deleterious to humanity, right? But in the long run, those skills become anti-skills. Right? They work against us. And until we're willing to make the social changes that are at the base of the addiction. So in the classroom, what I feel like my work is as a teacher is to recognize when I've lost the students, when they are numbed out, when they're not focused, and often get them up on their feet. You know, we do breath of joy a lot in my classes where you fling your arms up to the sky and fling them out and then fling them up to the sky and then bring your whole body down with a lion's breath, like huge. And if you do 20 breaths of joy, by the end, you've got so much prana inside of yourself that you can focus again. And there's other times when I realize that students are so exhausted or upset about something that we need to really stop and do a meditation. And you know what? I end up being able to still teach the material, but it's after they've rested. is after recognizing their bodies are telling me things that I need to read for. I don't know if that's helpful or not to you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I think it's very helpful. We have some listener questions that have come in, and I want to take the time to get those in. But also, and I want to thank those that take the time. I know that we get a lot of teachers that will comment, or either in this case comment, in some cases add questions, and then they tell us later on that they listen after school, so that they subscribe through iTunes, they listen after school. So if it's at all possible, I like to get their questions in. This one I think is
wonderful.
This one's a little more of a comment, but this one reads, I have been reading reviews and the information on your book. I would very much like to introduce it to my teachers group at our middle school. We are already integrating mindfulness, and I think it would be wonderful to add how your methods compare and how they would interface. So,
well, if I could just comment, I don't know where that listener lives, but I travel a lot of places. And if there's any way I could be part of that book group and sit there and listen to how people are understanding and making sense out of and arguing with, teaching with tenderness, I would love that. The more communication, the better.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. And oftentimes, those that send in questions will tell us where they're from. In this case, they haven't. But again, for the listener, when you hear this show, feel free to contact the show or to go ahead and contact Dr. Becky directly. We'll be giving her information here before the end of the show on how people can reach her directly. So that would be great. If there's a way that you can connect with them, it would be wonderful.
I'd love that.
Dr. Becky, the second question of a listener is, the place where this kind of teaching is so desperately needed in our inner schools, city schools. I am a volunteer in the after-school program in L.A., and we feel so limited when the school system is so closed-minded. The administration is doing the best they can just to keep the basics covered with budget cuts and standardized teaching requirements. Have you had any success or experience in introducing your work with inner city schools?
Well, I live in what they call the inner city, which, you know, another word for the inner city is the heart of the city. And I teach yoga at the Dorchester YMCA, which is also the heart of the city in Boston. And many of the people who come to my yoga class are public school teachers. So I think are facing a lot of the same challenges that people teaching in the LA public school system are facing. And so some of what I've learned from them is that, you know, when there's a broken chair or a broken table in a classroom at Boston Public Schools, you put them out in the hall for the janitor to come at some point and take them and fix them. But there are very few resources. What happens when a teacher is broken? You know, what happens when a teacher is bent? And so I think some of the work for teachers is to create spaces among each other to take care of ourselves. That if we are able to model self-care among ourselves, the students also see that as well. As soon as we are doing the yoga and the meditation and the walking meditation and the eating healthy and coming in clean and sober, we set a standard that students can then benefit from. Right? So even in very difficult circumstances that should never be that way, because inequalities in the school is one of the worst examples of oppression in the U.S., even amidst that, it's possible to hold within ourselves a hopefulness as long as we're taking care of our own selves first.
And Becky, because there are people like you out there, I think that helps express the fact that there is hope. So just keep doing what you're doing. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but we are so thankful for you to join us. And for anybody out there, if you want to reach Becky, you can go to her website, which is beckythompsonyoga.com. And if you're out there driving and you can't write this down, you can always go to the answersforthefamily.com website, and we will have all of Becky's information there, as well as Gabriella's information. So, Becky, again,
Alan,
thank you so much.
I really want to thank you for having me on the show. And, Gabriella, it's just been such a pleasure to hear your voice.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I wish you were sitting here in studio. But at least...
Yeah, me too.
I need to add to this. At least you're in Palm Springs, where I have a feeling it's a little bit warmer than Boston.
Yeah.
So I feel that you're safe there.
Yes, I'm binging on an extraordinary international film.
Okay.
All right. Okay. And so again, so for everybody out there, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, when our guest will be Ali Laprete, author of This Little Parent Stayed Home. And please visit our archives of past shows at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Vimeo, and many other outlets. If you like what you hear, please leave a review. It will help us reach more people and be greatly appreciated. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. Gabriella, where can people best reach you and learn more about what you're doing?
Well, the first thing is, don't type my last name. It's impossible. It's Dutch. You're not going to make it. So I changed it to Gabriella.global, because I'm all about the global space. And that's a way to find me. And if you type the hashtag Dare to Be Kind, you will find me everywhere. Facebook, my professional page is Kindness Expert. Twitter is Gabriella Van Ray, but again, it's just easier if you type Gabriella.global, and all my social icons are on there. Thank
great.
You, Alan.
You're welcome, and thanks to all. Remember, to everybody out there, be good human beings, and the best way you can do that is the message that Gabriella so beautifully presents. Dare to be kind to one another. Good day.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.